It's a pleasure to have today telling us about BeFacts.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. Thanks for coming. I probably, there are people from various backgrounds here, so stop me at any moment with comments or suggestions and so on. So I'll tell you about some work I've been doing over the last 2 years with Gabriel Cuomo, who is now at Princeton, and Avia Raviv-Moshe, and also with Mark Mezay, who is now at Oxford. There is a lot of related work from the last couple of years, particularly related to what I'm going to talk about today. Some papers of Max Metlitsky and Yifan Wang, and I should say it's also Simona Giombi, and collaborators. Also, I'll refer to experimental results to contrast the theory with. So that's something I'll be doing without references. So here I just collected, by experiment I mean simulations, quantum simulations. It's a philosophical question whether a quantum simulation is an experiment. So at any rate, some of this is quantum simulation, some is just DMRG, some are this recent breakthrough with the fuzzy sphere from Yin Chen and collaborators. These are various numerical methods. So I'll be referring to some results from these works, the experimental part. Mostly it's by Perizentoldin, Assad Wessel, Weber Voita, Adam Nahum, Franky Rossini-Vicari, and the recent results by Yin Chen and collaborators with Hu and Zhu. And I think they have an upcoming paper, right? I will be referring to some of the upcoming results. Okay, and the outline is that first I'll explain what is the subject of defects, where does it appear in nature, or why is it interesting in theory. And then I'll talk about the interplay of defects with global symmetries. Then I'll talk about what is the meaning of a quantum dimension. The notion of quantum dimension is familiar from anyon physics, from quantum Hall states. But I'll introduce the notion of quantum dimension for defects and show you why it is useful. Then I'll talk about an interesting subject that has to do with simple versus non-simple defects. We often call it nowadays symmetry breaking in quantum mechanics. I'll explain what that is. And then I'll talk about actually concrete examples where I'll make contact with these simulations. These are defects in the ferromagnet-paramagnet transitions. So this will be defects exactly at what used to be called the Curie point. The Curie point is where you are exactly at the ferromagnet-paramagnet transition. So we will consider some defects at the Curie point. Okay, so this is the outline. So first, what is the subject? So from a continuum point of view, is this big enough? So we will be discussing conformal field theories in D plus one space-time dimensions. So D will be the number of space dimensions. And in this talk, I'll only be talking about 2 plus 1. And it's been probably 50 years or so that people have been studying local operators with, trying to understand their scaling dimensions, their operator product expansion at the critical points. But there is also a class of extended operators. For instance, operators that are supported on a line. The extended operators are far less understood. Even in simple free field theories, we have no idea what is the space of extended operators. And extended operators can be viewed in two ways. So if you think about time as running up in a Lorentzian signature, an extended operator is just something that acts on the Hilbert space and has an extended support. It could be a line, it could be a surface. But if you just orient the same extended operator vertically in the time direction, then if you look at a time slice, it's just point-like, and it describes an impurity. So it's a modification of the Hamiltonian by some impurity. So the Hamiltonian will be the Hamiltonian of the critical point, which you can call a quantum phase transition. So I'll just write QPT. It's the Hamiltonian of the bulk degrees of freedom, which are at a fixed point. And then you couple it to some impurity, And the Hamiltonian for the impurity is some local interaction of this piece of garbage with whatever is nearby. So the classification of extended operators can be also be viewed as the classification of garbage, of pieces of garbage in the Hamiltonian quantization.
But the second one can be specialized into a line defect.
Yeah, if it's a surface operator, then it will be some impurity that's supported on a line. You can think about extended operators as impurities that are localized to a point, or to a line, or to a surface. Okay. Okay. So now, since the bulk is at a critical point, a conformal fixed point, this impurity may or may not flow to an interesting fixed point itself. So even if this piece of the Hamiltonian is already tuned to infinite correlation length, so the correlators are algebraic, due to this impurity, there might be a scale in the problem now. And there is a renormalization group flow. So there is an RG flow on the defect. There is no RG flow in the bulk, because the bulk is tuned to a fixed point, but there could be an RG flow on the defect. And we typically expect that this RG flow ends at what we call a conformal defect or a conformal impurity, depending on the community. So it ends at a conformal impurity in the long distance limit. Now, what is a conformal impurity? A conformal filter in 2 plus 1 dimensions preserves, without defects, preserves SO. In this signature, it would be 3,2. This is the conformal group that the CFT preserves. In the presence of a defect, which is a non-trivial conformal impurity, the symmetry is reduced. So I'll just write it here, and then I'll erase. So the symmetry is reduced to SO2,1 times SO2. In the presence of a conformal, this is the infrared limit. The symmetry would be reduced to that. If the defect is not conformal, the symmetry is reduced much more. There is no SO2,1. So this SO2,1 is due to conformal transformations that preserve the defect. And these are transverse rotations. So the transverse rotations around the impurity. I'm talking about point-like defects now, which are described by line operators. Line operator or a point-like impurity. So it's not strictly necessary that a conformal impurity will have transverse SO2 symmetry. There are known conformal impurities which break the transverse rotational symmetry. So this will not be important for anything I say today. But this is the key signature of when you are at the fixed point of the defect renormalization group flow. This is the same as SL2R, and it acts on if you call the coordinate along the defect t is at x equals to 0. Let's say that the defect is at x equals to 0, and the coordinate along the defect is t, then this SO2,1 acts just by Mobius transformations. Sorry, this might not be big enough. So t going to a t plus b over c t plus d, with the usual constraint that a d minus b c is 1. So this is how this SO2,1 would act on the defect at x equals to 0. And this symmetry extends to every x, of course. In condensed matter, we are interested in tuning to the conformal fixed point, putting an extended operator, namely some defect, and understanding whether it flows to a trivial or a non-trivial conformal defect. That's the zeroth order question. If some piece of impurity flows to a trivial fixed point, we say that the impurity is screened. If it flows to a non-trivial fixed point with a non-trivially acting SO2,1, we say that the impurity is conformal. So that's what they are interested in condensed matter. From the high-energy physics point of view, I think the question is clear. We essentially know nothing about extended operators at fixed points, so it's nice to play with some examples and get some intuition. Are there any questions about this general introduction? OK. Now, for what I'm going to explain today, I need to make this discussion about what is trivial versus what's not trivial a little bit more nuanced. So you could say that if the conformal filter to which this impurity flows is trivial, then you call it a screened trivial defect. But there is a small nuance that will be important today, and I want to explain it now. So for instance, you could take a conformal filter in 2 plus 1 dimensions and introduce a defect at x equals to 0, which is the following silly thing. It's just a decoupled spin a half quantum mechanical degree of freedom, a decoupled qubit. You could just introduce a completely decoupled qubit. Okay, so you take the Lagrangian of your conformal field theory, and you add a quantum mechanical system with two states, which is completely decoupled. So of course it influences nothing away from the impurity, but it has two states. There is up and down. So at this point there is now spin up and spin down. So in a technical sense, this defect is not quite the same as the unit operator because it has two states. So I'll denote it by 1 plus 1 with this sign. What this means is that it's a direct sum or a superposition of two states. So when the infrared limit of some interesting piece of garbage or impurity leads to a decoupled qubit, we have to keep this nuance in mind that this might mean that it's decoupled from the bulk, but still it's somewhat non-trivial. There could be two states on the defect. Okay? So technically, this is called a non-simple line defect. So people distinguish simple line defects from non-simple defects. Non-simple defects means that you can describe it as a direct sum of two defects. And a simple defect means that you cannot describe it as a direct sum of two defects. Okay, so this is the definition. It's important to keep this in mind because sometimes the RG flow naturally leads to such a scenario.
So for this non-simple defect, A and B
can also be conformal defects. Typically, A is some conformal defect, and B is some conformal defect, a distinct conformal defect. But the infrared leads to a direct sum. We'll see that this happens in ordinary magnets today. I'll show you examples that we know that this is the answer for some circumstances. Okay? So this is a small nuance about what it means for a defect to be simple versus non-simple, and also what do you mean by screened. You have to be somewhat careful about that. Okay. The next piece of introduction I want to go over is the interplay of defects with global symmetries. This is an interesting general subject. So ordinarily, we have local operators. And we know that global symmetries act on local operators by unitaries, where the unitary is some operator that has the fusion rules of G. So that's not quite the right notation. So U is an operator that implements an ordinary symmetry G. So that's how unitaries act on local operators. And we have a picture for how this is done. When we study word identities, we think about the local operator, and then we think about a symmetry as a codimension one topological surface that can enclose this operator, and this spits out this formula that I just wrote. So this is the picture that we have in mind geometrically. So you can ask, what is the interplay of line defects with global symmetries, ordinary global symmetries, G? So you cannot wrap a line with a sphere, obviously. Think about 2 plus 1 dimensions. So here the discussion has to be split into two different cases. So you think about the Hamiltonian language. In the Hamiltonian language, an impurity means that we modify the Hamiltonian by some local quantum mechanical degrees of freedom that interact with the bulk. This may or may not be invariant under the original symmetry G. So even if the original conformal theory had some symmetry G, the interactions with the impurity may not respect G. So this is the case where this line defect breaks G. That's case number one. Case number two is when the line defect preserves G. So I'll have to discuss them separately. So let's go over the case that the line defect breaks the symmetry G. Oh, this is something. So first of all, I want to explain this intuitive notion that the line defect breaks G or conserves G. What does it mean mathematically? Mathematically, the symmetry G is implemented by a two-dimensional surface in 2 plus 1 dimensions, some two-dimensional topological surface. So when I say that the defect preserves G, what it technically means is that I consider the intersection of that topological surface U that's supported on some surface sigma, and I consider the intersection with my line defect. If the intersection is topological, meaning you can wiggle this thing through in correlation functions without paying any price, so if this intersection is topological, we say that G is conserved. If this intersection is a non-topological operator, then we cannot freely move the symmetry surface through the defect, and therefore the symmetry is broken. So if this intersection is topological, I'll say that G is preserved. And if this intersection is non-topological, then we'll say that G is broken by the line defect. And these two cases have to be discussed separately. We'll see examples of both. Are there any questions? So if G is broken, let's discuss first the case that G is broken. It's a little bit simpler. If G is broken, again, you have to think about two. You have to think about two cases. If G is broken, one is that G is continuous, and it's broken to some subgroup H, and the other is when G is discrete. So let's first discuss the case that G is continuous, and the interaction with the line defect breaks G to H. So this leads to interesting operators on the defect, which have scaling dimension exactly delta equals 1, and they live in G mod H. They are called tilt operators in condensed matter. They are called tilt operators. So for every element in G mod H, we have an interesting local operator on the defect. This is not a bulk operator. It lives only on the defect. It's a defect operator, so it's only a function of t. And it has scaling dimension exactly 1. And the number of such operators is basically the dimension of the coset G mod H. So how do you derive the existence of these operators? You derive the existence of these operators essentially by the following thought experiment. You take your defect, and you wrap it with a topological surface which looks like this, like a cylinder. So you fuse your defect with the topological symmetry surface. This fusion leads to a new line defect at long distances, just by the RG. And this new line defect has slightly different coupling constants, because the original one does not preserve G. And the fusion, since it's done with a topological surface, is described by local operators of dimension 1. So it leads. So basically, the new line defect is given by the old line defect with some tilt operators integrated on the world line. So that's simply the derivation. Is that clear? Of wider? And maybe a more worded, more algebraic derivation, if you don't like geometric derivations, is that there is a conserved current in the bulk for the G symmetry. And if the symmetry is violated by the line defect, there is some delta function on the world volume of the defect times t. So t is just the operator that sits on the right-hand side of the conservation equation. And if you count dimensions, you'll see that t has scaling dimension 1, because this has d minus 1, so this has d, and this is a delta function on codimension 1. So this has to have dimension 1. So this is an algebraic proof, and this is a geometric proof. They're actually the same. OK. So this is the case that g is continuous. It leads to protected operators in the coset g mod h. If g is discrete, this surface is discrete, and we cannot do a small transformation. So we cannot conclude that there are protected operators if g is discrete. So what happens if g is discrete? Like z2. Think about g being the z2. If g is discrete, there are no protected operators, but something else interesting can be discussed, which is that you can discuss, let's say the g is z2, and the coupling breaks z2 explicitly. So now there are two line defects, plus and minus, which are they're related by flipping the sign of the z2 breaking operator on the line. And you can discuss this linear sum. So you can discuss a non-simple line, which is in a superposition. And now the superposition is G-symmetric. So if the original conformal defect breaks G, this superposition, or direct sum, is going to be G-symmetric. And you can ask, is this superposition stable under the renormalization group? So in other words, are there interesting G-invariant operators that act in this direct sum Hilbert space, which could, for instance, be added to the action and take this to be a trivial line defect? So you can ask, does this RG flow exist? OK. So what does this translate to? This translates to the following question. Yeah.
Can you derive how the local operators in a continuous case? What's their algebra structure? Can you derive it from this currents?
These ones? Yeah, because the currents that are conserved by the defect have a zero on the right-hand side. So only the currents that are broken by the defect have a non-vanishing right-hand side. What multiplies?
The local operators online.
There are operators that live on the line and they have some OP. But what? Oh, you're asking about the OP of these operators. You can. I didn't mean to get into it, but yes, these operators have an interesting algebra. But I didn't mean to get into it. Any other questions? OK, so here, this question is kind of is deep, and it's interesting. Let me just convey it in another language. So you could consider the following thought experiment, where the line plus morphs into the line minus, and the junction between the line plus and the line minus, both of which break the z2 symmetry explicitly, is some operator that I'll call the domain wall operator. It's an operator that is that can be moved. It's a conformal local operator that can be moved here. And an interesting question concerns with the scaling dimension of this domain wall operator as a defect operator. This domain wall operator is an operator that takes the line that breaks z2 in one way to the line that breaks z2 in the conjugate way. And if this operator is relevant, we can add it to this direct sum. And this would flow to a trivial line defect, most likely, at least in some examples. So the question whether this G-symmetric direct sum is stable or not is the same question as whether this is smaller than 1 or not. So if the scaling dimension of the domain wall operator is bigger than 1, we see that the direct sum fixed point is stable under renormalization group flows that preserve the symmetry. You can, of course, always flow from this direct sum to either the plus or minus line by adding G breaking operators. But if you insist on G preserving operators and you want to understand whether this direct sum is a stable impurity, you have to ask about the scaling dimension of the domain wall operator. So if this is true, we say that there is spontaneous symmetry breaking. This is, in some colloquial sense, just because the G symmetric line defects are a direct sum. So it's a very similar to spontaneous symmetry breaking. Okay. On the other hand, if the scaling dimension is smaller than one, we can add this. They will proliferate, and this will just flow to somewhere else. And there will be some conformal defect that preserves Z2 in an ordinary fashion, and it will be simple, most likely. So I'll just write it here, that if the scaling dimension is smaller than one, most likely there is a simple Z2 preserving line defect. Or more precisely, I'll just say that the direct sum is not stable. The direct sum is not stable in the RG sense. You could colloquially say that the domain wall proliferates, like in ordinary this is how ordinary symmetries are restored. Yeah.
I wonder, in the case of continuous symmetry breaking, does it make sense to make the direction dynamical, something analogous to that sum? But
yes. Yes. You could. I'll talk about it. This is called the Kondo problem. That you add quantum mechanical degrees of freedom that propagate on this coset, and you couple the tilt operators to those degrees of freedom. You can do, that's a variant of the Kondo problem. I'll mention it later. Yeah, it makes sense to do that. Any other questions? And then you restore G, of course. Then the new line defect is G symmetric. Any? Yes?
If the sum is unstable, do you reach it from some kind of fine-tuning of that domain?
If it's not stable, yes, yes. You can reach this by fine-tuning for sure, because it's a fixed point of the renormalization group flow. The interesting question is whether it's stable. Because if the domain wall operator is relevant, presumably if you don't fine tune, it will proliferate and it will not be a stable phase. So it's an interesting question. Yeah.
But it could describe something of this position.
Yeah, I mean, the question is whether this is multicritical or stable. If it's stable if delta is smaller than one. If delta is bigger than one, it's not a stable line defect. Okay. So this is a close analog of what you might call symmetry breaking in quantum mechanics. You might call it symmetry breaking on the impurity. It's just a terminology. Okay. So this covers the case where G is broken, the continuous and the discrete. Now I'll just say one thing about the case that G is preserved. So far I told you various concepts you could use to discuss line defects that break the symmetry. Now, let me just mention what happens if G is preserved. If G is preserved, you might think, okay, so the impurity preserves the symmetry. What's the big deal? There is nothing interesting to discuss. The local operators on the defect, which I'll call O hat as a function of T, will transform linearly under U. So they transform under U in the same way as bulk operators. So if the line defect preserves the symmetry, then local operators on the impurity transform under G in some representation. So nothing interesting is happening yet. But there is something. Something interesting can happen in the following situation. So for defect operators, they transform in linear representations. But you can consider a more exotic situation where the line defect has an endpoint. So suppose there is an endpoint. So suppose the line defect has some operator at the endpoint. So let's call it O endpoint. It's some scaling field. Some operator with some scaling dimension. And this operator does not have to transform in linear representations of G. So that's the slight tweak or the slight nuance in this situation. endpoint, while defect operators are in linear representations of G, endpoint operators do not have to be in linear representations of G. They can be in projective representations of G. So they can be in projective reps.
Sorry, can I bring you back just to this? Because I feel like I'm almost getting the punchline, but I did not get it. So why is this called symmetry breaking? You create a singlet state of plus and minus, and then if delta is bigger than one, that singlet state is stable, right?
Yes, yes.
So it's, why is it breaking any symmetry? Because
it means that, yeah, you're asking about the technical things or a terminology?
Basically, are we calling it breaking a symmetry? This is saying that I can construct a singlet guy out of things.
But it has to be but it will be non-simple. So what is it similar to? You know, in quantum mechanics, you can say that this potential breaks. Of course, the ground state is symmetric, but it's kind of a sum of two states. And if you go to, you know, large volume in QFT, it actually becomes a sum of two different superselection sectors. So this symbol that I've been using class, you should think about it as superselection, because these two defects do not communicate with each other, meaning all correlation functions add up. So it's literally a superselection. This is what design means for line defects, that you take one defect and you do a superselection sector with another defect. So some people say that if the direct sum is a stable defect, since it's two superselection sectors, each breaking the Z2, you could say that this is like symmetry breaking. That's what happens in symmetry breaking in infinite volume.
Yeah. So the existence of this state allows me to then put just a plus or just a minus if I want.
That's one thing. But practically what it means experimentally is that if your impurity preserves a symmetry and you somehow know that it's going to preserve some symmetry because the lattice construction preserves that symmetry, you know that you'll end up in a in a ground state which has two superselection sectors. So it's conceptually very similar to symmetry breaking, because it's a stable phase of the RG, this direct sum. In most cases, it's not a stable phase of the RG. There is a way to flow to something more elementary, sometimes even a trivial line defect. But if it's a stable phase, you just know that you're going to end up with two superselection sectors. So for that reason, this notion seems appropriate terminologically.
Now you use some words saying if my defect preserves the symmetry. I thought this was the case where it breaks the symmetry.
No. So if in the lattice you have, in the lattice the defect is some piece of garbage, some modification of the Hamiltonian. If it breaks the symmetry from the get-go, you'll end up either here or here, in one of those defects most likely, depending on the parameters that broke the symmetry, if they are negative or positive, some kind of convention.
Yes.
But if your defect preserves the symmetry, and if this is a stable stable line defect, you're going to end up with two superselection sectors.
Okay.
So it's like a Hamiltonian that is invariant under Z2, but it breaks the Z2 spontaneously, so you end up with superselection sectors.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I think it's a good analogy. But it's perfect because I don't need to take a large volume limit. Usually to discuss symmetry breaking, we need to take large volume limit. Here, the direct sum is something that is exact even in finite volume. So there is a small difference, but it's very analogous. Okay, so going back to the G-preserving case, there is a small nuance here, as I said, that endpoint operators can be in projective representations. How do you intuitively understand that? You look at the Hilbert space of the theory on a sphere with an impurity in the north pole. So you go from flat space to the sphere with an impurity at the north pole. That's dual to the endpoint operator spectrum by radial quantization. So it could be that the ordinary Hilbert space on the sphere is, of course, in linear representations of the symmetry. This is because this is dual to the space of local operators by radial quantization. But with one impurity, the Hilbert space could be in a projective rep. We cannot rule it out. This will happen in some examples later in magnets. When you know that this is true, this leads to a constraint on the RG flow. So claim, this is a claim. This is not movable. So the claim is that if you have a line defect where the endpoints are in a projective rep, then it cannot flow to a trivial unit operator in the infrared. So it's a simple claim that we'll use soon. Claim is that if this projective rep for the endpoints is satisfied, if you have a projective representation for the non-trivial projective representation for the endpoints, this implies that the infrared of such line defects cannot be just the unit. Cannot be just the unit operator. It could be the unit. So it could be, for instance, 1 plus 1, but it cannot be just 1. So it rules out that RG flows to trivial defects, completely screened trivial defects. Is that clear? It's just because hooking an operator in a projective rep is something that's invariant under the renormalization group. So if in the ultraviolet there are such operators, you cannot make that defect disappear completely. It has to be possible. It has to be possible to hook it to a projective rep endpoint. So it's an invariant of the RG. Is that clear? Okay.
So it could be some decoupled qubit, right?
Yeah, it could be a decoupled qubit, but it cannot be literally one. It cannot be a trivial line. So you can probably phrase it using SPT phases, but I get nervous doing that because it's a gapless state. But you could colloquially say that the line defect is attached to an SPT phase, and therefore this is invariant under the renormalization group. Okay? Okay. So this finishes my introduction. Oh, I have one final thing. One final thing, and I'm done with the introduction. And we'll go into interesting examples. So the final thing that I'll be using today is the following. So if you have a line defect, in condensed matter, it's natural to think about it as a point-like impurity. But we can also just make it into a circular line defect in Euclidean signature by doing a weak rotation of the QFT. And then we can compute the expectation value of the circular line defect. This is going to be some function of the radius. Because the line defect is not necessarily conformal. So this gives you some function of the radius. This function of the radius is called the defect entropy. And this function of the radius is such that for very large radii, it goes to a number that I'll call G infrared. This is the quantum dimension of the fixed point at long distances of the corresponding line defect. And at short distances, it goes to the quantum dimension in the ultraviolet. So it just goes to numbers because you have conformal symmetry at long distances and short distances. So the radius dependence drops at long, short, and short distances. So this function just goes to pure numbers, which are called the quantum dimensions in the UV and the infrared. And there is a theorem that the first derivative of this defect entropy is negative. This is a general theorem. And this implies that GIR is smaller than GUV. So I'll be using that today. Now, those of you that know the fractional quantum Hall effect, this object is called the quantum dimension of the anion. And it's known from the theory of anions that G is bigger than 1 for anions. This is an old theorem. I don't remember by whom. For conformal defects, this will not be true. So we'll see today many defects where the quantum dimension is smaller than 1. But it's still positive by unitarity. It's always positive by unitarity, but it could be smaller than 1. OK? So this finishes the introduction. Are there any questions?
Can you remind me how do you make sure to canonically put it on a circle? There could be some counterterms control by extrinsic.
Yeah, I wanted to swipe it under the rug. So what you actually do to define the defect entropy is that you act on the expectation value with the logarithm first, and then R d over dr, and then minus 1. And this spits out a scheme independent quantity. But I just wanted to not discuss that. Yeah, so you can canonically remove the counter term, and then there is a quantity that's actually decreasing rigorously. Okay, any final questions about the introduction? So I'll show you now examples where we can apply these ideas. No, this theorem is only about the RG flow on the defect. The bulk is fixed, and it's at a fixed point.
And we have example of that RG flow.
No, I never looked at examples where there is an RG flow in the bulk. This is a theorem just about line defects. Okay, so let's now discuss examples. Oh, maybe here, just for orientation, the G function of the trivial defect, just trivial screen defect, with no, which is simple, is obviously 1, yes? So we will see some examples where just using these inequalities, we can rule out a simple defect. And the G function of a direct sum, if you have a direct sum of two defects, the G function adds up, because these are two different super selection sectors. We'll use that, OK? OK, now the first example, which is the most elementary example, almost the most elementary example. So I have to choose a CFT in 2 plus 1 dimensions. This will be just the Ising CFT, the transition from Z2 breaking to Z2 preserving phase. It can be realized as Yin Chen taught us by fermions at half filling. It can be realized by a million other ways, at zero temperature quantum phase transitions. It's even realized by water, as you know, at high temperatures and high pressures. So it's a fixed point that appears in many different applications. I'll just write the Lagrangian for this fixed point. OK? I'm not putting any coefficient in front of phi to the 4. I'm just imagining that it's tuned to the fixed point. So we are at the fixed point. This is the action of Ising in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And so what's the line defect? The simplest line defect you can imagine is called the pinning defect in condensed matter. It's called the pinning line defect. And it's just the exponential of some coefficient times the integral of phi times dt. OK, this is the simplest possible line defect that you can imagine. And what does it describe physically? How do we manufacture it in the lab? So remember that one interesting deformation of the Ising model is linear. This is called an external magnetic field. But usually, when we discuss the phase diagram of the Ising model, we have an external magnetic field throughout the whole space. This describes an external magnetic field which is localized to one point. So the way it's manufactured in quantum simulators or in other applications is by putting localized magnetic field. So you're just asking, what's the response of the system to magnetic field that is like going through a few lattice sites, or is it just localized in a small region of space rather than throughout the whole sample? OK, so you want to understand what's the infrared limit of this line defect. Is it trivial? Is it not trivial? What's the fate of a local magnetic field? OK, so I'll discuss it now. So if gamma is very small, so you begin at short distances with very, very small magnetic field, then clearly this is a relevant perturbation, and gamma is going to grow, because the scaling dimension of the order parameter in Ising is like 0.51. So clearly this is a relevant perturbation of the empty sample, of the empty line, of the trivial line defect. So the quantum dimension in the ultraviolet is 1, and some RG flow begins. By this theorem, it therefore follows that you cannot screen this magnetic field. This line defect will flow to a non-trivial fixed point, because the G of the infrared cannot be 1, given that G of the UV is 1. So G of the infrared has to be smaller than 1. G of infrared has to be smaller than 1, which means that this flows to actually a conformal defect. So this line operator does flow to a conformal defect. So actually, this was a question in condensed matter for many years, whether localized magnetic field is screened or not. But it follows immediately from the G theorem that it cannot be screened. This is the simplest example of a conformal line defect in an interacting fixed point.
Can you prove it is conformal?
No, I cannot prove that it's conformal. I can prove that it cannot be screened. And most likely, it's going to end up at some conformal fixed point, as you know. Now, we have, thanks to numerical simulations and a lot of theoretical work, we have assembled interesting information about this line defect. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about it. It exhibits some of this phenomena I talked about. First of all, what are the symmetries? So the symmetry of the Ising model is just Z2. This operator, this line operator, breaks the Z2 explicitly because gamma is odd. If you flip the sign of phi, gamma is odd. So this is Z2 breaking. So this line defect breaks the Z2. That's one fact. I actually do not know if there are interesting line defects that preserve the Z2, except for the non-simple one that I'll talk about now, which is a multicritical. So I don't know if there are simple Z2 preserving line defects, to be precise. So this flows to a fixed point, and the scaling dimension of phi as a defect operator, so now I'm going to talk about the infrared fixed point. What do we know about the infrared fixed point of this line operator? We know it from a lot of theoretical work, which involves epsilon expansion, large N, and also from numerical simulations and quantum simulators. So I'm just going to summarize what do we know. So this, the scaling dimension of phi hat, which is the defect operator in the infrared fixed point, is 1.5, give or take. It's between 1.4 optimistically and 1.6. That's for more or less what I know. I think there is much better precision now. So you see that in the ultraviolet, it's 0.5, but it picks up a huge anomalous dimension as it flows to the infrared. And the g function of the infrared fixed point is probably, as far as I know, from large N and epsilon expansion and this and that, it's between 0.6 and 0.7, I think. Is that correct? So I think this is the value that we know now. And then the final thing that I wanted to tell you is about the domain wall operator. So we also know the domain wall operator scaling dimension from simulations, from epsilon expansion, and maybe from large N, though we haven't been able to solve this problem at large N yet. The G function and delta we solved at large N, but the domain wall operator we did not. So we just know it from the epsilon expansion. And you find that it's between 0.7 and 0.8. I would say that's more or less the range. This is interesting because of the following facts. So now let's consider the direct sum of the plus and minus defect. So let's consider this direct sum that I discussed before. This is a Z2 preserving line defect, which is non-simple. You can ask if it's stable under the renormalization group. And you see that the domain wall operator is relevant. It has scaling dimension smaller than 1. So this phase, which is Z2 breaking, is unstable. And we believe that if we proliferate the domain wall operator, namely we add it to the action, the whole thing flows to a trivial defect with g equals 1. And indeed, this picture is consistent. Because what is the g function of this direct sum? It's the g function of plus the g function of minus. And given this range, it's something like 1.2 to 1.4. So this RG flow is allowed by the G theorem. On the other hand, if the G function of this line defect was smaller than 1/2, this RG flow would not be allowed. And you could, and there will be some, I'll discuss some examples like that soon. So in summary, in the Ising case, this particular defect is conformal. The symmetry breaking phase is unstable. And we have some data about the infrared fixed point. We actually have a lot of data from large N numerics and epsilon expansion. Are there any questions about it? This is the simplest interacting line defect that we know of. OK, now I'll get going with more.
Maybe one more thing, because I felt your sign there was a gap because of the G theorem you call, and I know that the fact that this was relevant implied there was the G theorem, but I failed to understand your argument. That guarantee that this was a flow to a conformal defect?
Well, I cannot prove that it flows to a conformal defect. The question in condensed matter was phrased as follows. You introduce small magnetic field through a small chunk of the sample, and you want to know if it's screened at long distances.
Yeah.
By screened, what it means is that the defect is decoupled. That would mean that G is 1 or some integer if it was a direct sum of decoupled defects.
Okay.
The G theorem forbids that scenario. Okay. It does not prove that you have to flow to some conformal fixed point. There could be maybe more violent options, but this is the most likely option. It just, yeah, the G theorem just rules out this idea that it could be screened at long distances. Okay. Now I'll quickly go over the ON model case. In the ON model case, there is some new, conceptually new things that happen. So you consider the same line defect, essentially, but now you just take the first component of the order parameter. In the ON model, I remind you, the order parameter is a vector with n components. So the generalization of what I said to the ON model is this. And now this breaks the symmetry in a different, in a more general pattern. So this explicitly breaks the symmetry from ON to ON minus 1. So in this line, this line defect also flows to a fixed point. So this also flows to a non-trivial fixed point, and we have a lot of data about it from the same sources as before, namely large N, epsilon expansion, and so on. And there are tilt operators here. So there are n minus one tilt operators in this example, which are protected with scaling dimension exactly 1. And about this example, I just wanted to tell you one thing. What if we do a direct sum of the line defect with coupling gamma and the line defect with coupling minus gamma? So let's study this again. This would be a line defect that preserves a slightly bigger symmetry than ON minus 1. It would preserve Z2 times ON minus 1. So some lattice constructions could guarantee that the line defect preserves the symmetries. You could ask, is this a stable phase of map? Is this a stable phase? So again, you have to go through the computation of the domain wall operator. Unfortunately, there is no data yet. We don't know what's the scaling dimension of the domain wall operator from numerical simulations as a function of n. This is not known yet. As I said, for n equals 1, it's like 0.7, 0.8. But I can say that just from the epsilon expansion, it seems guaranteed that this is bigger than 1 for at least n bigger or equal to 3. I just think that this is going to be true numerically. Just from the epsilon expansion. So this means that this line defect, so this is this is an example of spontaneous symmetry breaking. We see that if you engineer an impurity preserving these symmetries, it will have to be a non-simple line defect. For n equals 2, I'm not sure. The G function is still slightly bigger than 1, and the domain wall operator is borderline, so I don't want to commit about n equals 2. But in the general case, we certainly believe that this symmetry breaking does happen. Okay, so this is a small comment I wanted to make.
So
yeah.
You have something in the problem.
Yeah. Most of what I'm. So we solved this model in large N exactly. We wrote a whole paper about it. There is some large N saddle point, and you can solve everything you want. Yes, the phenomenon persists. I think we don't know if it goes down to n equals 2 or 3. I looked at the numerics, extrapolated our results to small n yesterday, and I wasn't sure. But for n bigger than 3, I think it's definitely true. So this is a concrete prediction. Now I want to discuss the last case, where there is this phenomenon of projective representations in magnets. Are there any questions about the spinning field business? Yeah.
So the G function of non-simple defect larger than 1 does not necessarily mean you can go back to the trivial, right? Because there could be some kind of non-stable fixed point separating.
Yeah, for sure. So I don't want to go too much into that, but for n equals 2, the g function is still bigger than a half, according to the large n extrapolation we do. So we do expect that there is a domain wall operator at n equals 2 that would destabilize this SSB, but I'm not sure. It's very borderline, and it will be decided by numerics, I hope, soon. Okay.
And for open, you may consider other kinds of domain walls. For example, rotate the parameter by 150 degrees.
Yes, for sure. Here I only showed you what happens if you try to discuss defects preserving this symmetry. You can try to ask, what about Z4 times ON minus 1? You can say, okay, I have a lattice model which with a defect that preserves, some other subgroup. So yeah, you might like rotate gamma by some subgroup of ON. Yeah, you can probably conceive of Z4 times ON minus 1, for instance. Yeah, I think you can do that.
Yeah. Something you could do is you could take an auxiliary spin system and then the collection matrix at gamma I coupled to different phi i's. And it gets matrices as random, then you operate all the symmetry. So there should be defects that break all of the symmetry, but it's still reasonably.
By random, you meant literally random?
The collection, whatever. Right. And somebody writes some matrices.
But you need to involve the higher tensors of phi.
No, just gamma I phi I.
What do you mean? If you just do that?
But gamma is a matrix. It's a 2x2 matrix, say.
This is a 2x2 matrix.
Each gamma I is a 2x2 matrix, which means you don't, if you pick them sufficiently, it might have to be bigger than 2x2, perhaps, n by n. I don't know. As soon as it gets big enough, you will be able to break all the ON symmetry.
I see. I didn't think about this question. Okay, so let's see, I have more time. I want to discuss the... I ran out of time. Yeah, I wanted to just give you a quick... as you know, in the history of QFT, the Kondo problem played a very... I lost my eraser. The Kondo problem played a very important role in the history of the subject. And there is an analog of the Kondo problem in 2+1 dimensions, which I wanted to quickly say. I'll say literally very few things about it. So this again concerns with the problem of magnets, the ferromagnet-paramagnet transition. And it's very similar to what Davide just said. So I'm going to focus on the O3 model. So in the condensed matter literature, the problem that I'm going to discuss now is called the boson Kondo. In particle physics, I'm thinking about this problem as the simplest analog of a Wilson line. You'll see why. So I'm going to talk about the O3 model at the fixed point, where phi is a tree vector. And the line defect is a little similar to what Davide just said. Since phi is naturally a matrix with some index A that goes from 1 to 3, you just multiply it into an SU2 matrix in the spin S representation. And then you take a trace, you do pass ordering, and these matrices SA, they're in the spin S representation. OK, this is an interesting line defect that you can define in the O3 model. And the sum over A is from 1 to 3. And these are just classical matrices in the spin S representation. This is very similar to a Wilson line. When we define Wilson lines, we have a gauge field times the spin S matrix. Here we have scalars. It's a simple analog of that. Now, what does it describe physically? Physically, it describes a magnet where at some point, instead of a spin a half a qubit, you put a spin S qubit. That's it. So you just take one side, put a spin S qubit. That's described by this line defect. Because it's just an interaction of the spin with the order parameter. So it's very easy to manufacture numerically, perhaps even in real life in the ferromagnetic paramagnetic transition. So here again, there is a question of what is the infrared limit? Is it conformal? Is it not conformal? So here, I don't have time to discuss it. I'll just say one thing about this problem. I'll say two things. One is that large S is solvable. That's one of the papers I wrote over the last 2 years. We found an exact solution of this problem in the large S limit. And it's intuitively clear why there is an exact solution. It's because SU2 matrices commute when they're very large. So you can forget about the pass ordering. S going to infinity is actually a solvable line defect. You can compute anything you want. And we know the scaling dimensions. We know the G function. So the G function of the UV is 2S plus 1, since gamma is 0. And the G function of the infrared is 2S plus a half. It's not really a half. It's like 0.45 something, but roughly a half. Some number that's of order half. So there is a small reduction in the G function at large S. OK, so the large S limit is solvable. The small S limit is the one that's most interesting experimentally. In particular, the most interesting case experimentally is S equals a half, where these matrices are 2 by 2. It's not known yet what is the infrared limit. But here I wanted to give you, in the last minute, a proof that it cannot be trivial. So I have a proof now that it's not screened. The proof involves this idea of the endpoints. For S equals a half, we have a spin a half qubit on the line coupled to the order parameter. But the proper symmetry of the bulk is O3. It's not SU2, it's SO3. So therefore, the endpoints of this boson-Kondo problem are in a spin a half representation. So if S is Z plus a half, this is in a projective representation. So this in this line defect, the endpoints are in a projective representation for odd spin. For half integer spin. For odd representations. This implies that the S equals a half problem cannot flow to a completely trivial line. So the flow where it goes to literally just the unit operator cannot happen. It can flow to 1 plus 1. So that's your next guess. What about S equals a half flowing to 1 plus 1? This contradicts the G theorem. Because G of the ultraviolet is 2. So the G of the infrared cannot be 2. So this proves the idea that this line is screened. And therefore, it seems that for every S, it's a conformal defect. So that's the last thing I wanted to show you, a small application of this idea with projective representations. I'll stop here. I don't want to go more over time. Thank you so much. I don't see any.
For lot operators in the bulk, the fault effects, we have a SO3.2 symmetry. And the physically relevant representations are passed with conformal primers.
Okay.
What are the relevant representations of the SO2.1 times SO2 on the defects?
These are the primaries on the defect. Conformal primaries on the defect. So and they have descendants.
We still require the defects to be primaries.
Yeah. I mean, if you have a conformal defect, then you have some. You don't require. It's just that operators come in families. So there could be, if there is an operator on the defect, you can apply derivatives k times and create descendants. But normal derivatives are not descendants. Normal derivatives are genuine new operators that you have to compute their scaling dimensions.
I mean, for the kind of local operators, we require them to be conformal primaries because of state operator map.
No, we don't require. The state operator map applies to all operators.
I'm asking it every
primaries time. And descendants.
But by unitary, everything is going to be either primary or descendant. Are you asking if the defect interchanges them?
The state operator map works for all operators, primaries and descendants.
Right, but the fact that we want highest weight representations.
We don't want. It's just their unitary representations are highest weight. And it's the same for defects. What do you mean we want highest weight?
Well, we usually want to consider conformal field theories with spectrum bounded from the bulk.
Yes.
That tells us to consider.
Yes. So it's the same. We want scaling dimensions of defect operators to be non-negative, and we want the representations to be unitary, So we have highest weight representations. I think it's exactly the same.
For this, in the case of local operators, you can argue for the OP of local operators.
Correct.
Can we argue for OP of two lines?
There is no papers about this in the literature, but the answer is obviously yes. It's obvious that when you, the subject of fusion of conformal defects, I don't know the literature, but I don't know that there are papers about this. Of course, there are lots of papers in 2D, in 1 plus 1, for Kondo defects and Verlinde lines. But for non-trivial conformal defects like in these magnets, I think there is no literature.
I mean, but the beneficial that this diffusion is a defect, I mean, you can ask for it.
Yeah. It's obviously a line defect. The fusion is obviously some new line defect, which you can call like this, you know, some kind of effective line defect. Which one? I don't know. Like, what if you fuse two of those with different spins? Does the spin add up? Maybe you get a non-simple line where you sum over all the spins that appear in the decomposition. You know what I mean? You multiply spin S and spin S prime. You probably get in the ultraviolet a direct sum, a non-simple line, which is a sum. That direct sum is not RG stable, probably. There are domain wall operators. I haven't discussed them, but there are domain wall operators between spin S and spin S prime. They can proliferate. Who knows what's the infrared limit? I have no idea.
What is in some sense, it starts with something which is the product of the G's, and then it flows down.
The what?
I wonder if there is some sense in which this nearby defects have a G function, which is the product of the original G's, and then flow down from there.
Yes, of course. But in localization, for supersymmetric BPS defects, what you said is true.
And in the automatic sphere,
for here,
parallel, yeah, not obvious.
I mean, if gamma is small, and you multiply line defects which are non-conformal with small gamma, I think you do get the non-simple line that then flows to something. Now you can start from the conformal fixed point of these gammas and fuse them. And hopefully the diagram commutes, and you get the same answer as if you started from small gamma. So then what David has said is true. Like, there will be, in some sense, a G function, which is a product in the UV, and it will flow somewhere. But you have to rely on the diagram commuting, that doing the fusion and then the RG flow is the same as doing the RG flow and then the fusion. You see what I'm saying? But I don't think anybody looked at this. And to know where this leads, you have to know the dimensions of domain wall operators between different S's. Because you get non-simple defects after you do these products. And I have no idea what their scaling dimensions are.
So can you make sure the precise statement is there? So what you proved is G function cannot increase or it should decrease?
What we proved is that if in the ultraviolet the operator is relevant, it cannot be equal. It's a strict inequality then.
Okay.
Because the sum rule that we have is piecewise positive. So if there is a small section of the RG flow where there is an RG flow, all the contributions add up. So it's not an oscillatory sum rule. Therefore, we can really prove that it's bigger. It's not a weak inequality, it's a strong inequality, which is not the case for A theorems and these kind of things.
Yeah. Any more questions?
So for the last equation, is it able to come up with some Lagrangian formulation? For example, we start with both degrees of fusion and add some operators to the line.
Yeah, you want a Lagrangian formulation of this, like we do for Wilson lines? Yeah, you can do that. You can add world line variables, which represent these matrices by bilinears. I think maybe it's called fermion. I don't know. What's the word in condensed matter? You can represent the spin matrices by bilinears of fermions. Like you can do Z. So the way you can even do it without fermions. So the way to do it is you can have two complex quantum mechanical degrees of freedom with a first order kinetic term and a constraint. And then you can look at these combinations. And this represents the, and then you just couple these Z variables to your O3 model. And you can write an explicit Lagrangian.
Hmm?
Spin on sprite, yeah, Yeah, there are some spinons. Yeah, spinons. It's, we call it coadjoint orbit in high energy physics. It's the coadjoint orbit of SU2.